was downstate Illinois for right here on this very spot indicated.
That made him kind of look like Kirk Douglas. He was real cute, but he had a temper on him. I got a 2-foot scar right across my back where he cut me with an ice pick. You want to see it?
She started to hoist up her blouse, but I stopped her. She went on and on like that for ages. Every once in a while, the guy in the corner, who was clearly eavesdropping, would grin, showing large yellow teeth. I expect Floyd had torn his leg off in a moment of high spirits. At the end of our conversation, the barmaid gave me a sideways look, as if I had been slyly trying to fool her, and said,
"Say, where do you come from anyway, honey?"
I didn't feel like giving her my whole life story, so I just said, "Great Britain."
"Well, I'll tell you one thing, honey," she said. "For a foreigner, you speak English real good."
Afterwards, I retired with a six-pack to my motel, where I discovered that the bed, judging by its fragrance and shape, had only recently been vacated by a horse. It had a sag in it so severe that I could only see the TV at its foot by splaying my legs to their widest extremity. It was like lying in a wheelbarrow. The night was hot, and the air conditioner, an aged Philco window unit, expended so much energy making a noise like a steelworks that it could only manage to emit the feeblest and most occasional puffs of cool air. I lay with a six-pack on my chest, effectively immobilized, and drank the beers one by one. On the TV was a talk show presided over by some smooth asshole in a blazer whose name I didn't catch. He was a kind of guy for whom personal hair care was clearly a high priority. He exchanged some witless banter with a bandleader, who, of course, had a silvery goatee, and then turned to the camera and said in a solemn voice, "But seriously, folks, if you've ever had a personal problem or trouble at work, or you just can't seem to get a grip on life, I know you're going to be real interested in what our first guest has to tell you tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Joyce Brothers." As the band launched into a perky tune and Joyce Brothers strode on stage, I sat up as far as the bed would allow me and cried, "Joyce! Joyce Brothers!" as if to an old friend. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't seen Joyce Brothers for years, and she hadn't changed a bit. Not one hair on her head had altered a fraction since the last time I saw her droning on about menstrual flow in 1962. It was as if they had kept her in a box for 25 years. This was as close as I would ever come to time travel. I watched agog as she and Mr. Smoothie chattered away about penis envy and fallopian tubes. I kept expecting him to say to her, "Now seriously, Joyce, here's a question all America has been wanting me to ask you. What sort of preparations do you take to keep yourself looking like that? Also, when are you going to do something about that hairstyle? And finally, why is it, do you think, that talk show bozos like me all over America keep inviting you back again and again?" Because, let's be frank, Joyce Brothers is pretty dull. I mean, if you turn on the Johnny Carson show and she is one of the guests, you know that absolutely everybody in town must be at some really big party or premiere. She is like downstate Illinois made flesh. Still, like most immensely boring things, there is something wonderfully comforting about her. Her cheery visage on the glowing box at the foot of my bed made me feel strangely warm and whole and at peace with the world. Out here in this crud-bucket motel in the middle of a great empty plain, I began for the first time to feel at home. I somehow knew that when I awoke I would see this alien land in a new but oddly familiar light. With a happy heart I fell asleep and dreamt gentle dreams of southern Illinois and the rolling Mississippi River and Dr. Joyce Brothers. And it's not often you hear anyone say that, either. Chapter 4. In the morning I crossed the Mississippi at Quincy. Somehow it didn't look as big or majestic as I had remembered it. It was stately, it was imposing, it took whole minutes to cross, but it was also somehow flat and dull. This may have had something to do with the weather, which was likewise flat and dull. Missouri looked precisely the same as Illinois, which had looked precisely the same as Iowa. The only difference was that the car license plates were a different color. Near Palmyra, I stopped at a roadside cafe for breakfast and took a seat at the counter. At this hour, just after 8 in the morning, it was full of farmers. If there is one thing farmers sure do love, It is to drive into town and spend half a day, a whole day in winter, sitting at a counter with a bunch of other farmers, drinking coffee and teasing the waitress in a half-assed sort of way. I had thought that this was the busiest time of their year, but they didn't seem to be in any rush. Every once in a while, one of them would put a quarter on the counter, get up with the air of a man who has just loaded 6 gallons of coffee into his belly, tell Tammy not to do anything he wouldn't do, and depart. A moment later, we would hear the grip of his pickup truck's wheels on the gravel drive. Someone would say something candid about him, provoking appreciative laughter. And the conversation would drift lazily back to hogs, state politics, Big Eight football, and, when Tammy was out of earshot, sexual predilections, not least Tammy's. The farmer next to me had only 3 fingers on his right hand. It is a little-noticed fact that most farmers have parts missing off them. This used to trouble me when I was small. For a long time I assumed that it was because of the hazards of farming life. After all, the farmers deal with lots of dangerous machinery. But when you think about it, a lot of people deal with dangerous machinery, and only a tiny proportion of them ever suffer permanent injury. Yet there is scarcely a farmer in the Midwest over the age of 20 who has not, at some time or other, had a limb or digit yanked off and thrown into the next field by some noisy farmyard implement. To tell you the absolute truth, I think farmers do it on purpose. I think working day after day beside these massive threshers and balers with their grinding gears and flapping fan belts and complex mechanisms, they get a little hypnotized by all the noise and motion. They stand there staring at the whirring machinery, and they think, I wonder what would happen if I just stuck my finger in there a little bit. I know that sounds crazy, but you have to realize that farmers don't have a whole lot of sense in these matters because they feel no pain. It's true. Every day in the Des Moines Register you can find a story about a farmer who has inadvertently torn off an arm and then calmly walked 6 miles into the nearest town to have it sewn back on. The stories always say, Jones, clutching his severed limb, told his physician, I seem to have cut my dern arm off, Doc. It's never, Jones, spurting blood, jumped around hysterically for 20 minutes, fell into a swoon, and then tried to run in 4 directions at once, which is how it would be with you or me. Farmers simply don't feel pain. That little voice in your head that tells you not to do something because it's foolish and will hurt like hell, and for the rest of your life somebody will have to cut up your food for you, doesn't speak to them. My grandfather was just the same. He would often be repairing the car when the jack would slip, and he would call out to you to come and crank it up again as he was having difficulty breathing, or he would run over his foot with a lawnmower, or touch a live wire, shorting out the whole of Winfield, but leaving himself unscathed, apart from a ringing in the ears and a certain lingering smell of burnt flesh. Like most people from the rural Midwest, he was practically indestructible. There are only 3 things that can kill a farmer: lightning, rolling over in a tractor, and old age. It was old age that got my grandfather. I drove on 40 miles south to Hannibal, and went to see Mark Twain's boyhood home, a trim and tidy whitewashed house with green shutters set incongruously in the middle of the downtown. It cost $2 to get in, and was a disappointment. It purported to be a faithful reproduction of the original interiors, but there were wires and water sprinklers clumsily evident in every room. I also very much doubt that young Samuel Clemens' bedroom had Armstrong vinyl on the floor, the same pattern as in my mother's kitchen, I was interested to note, or that his sister's bedroom had a plywood partition in it. You don't actually go in the house. You look at it through the windows. At each window there is a recorded message telling you about that room, as if you were a moron. This is the kitchen. This is where Mrs. Clemens would prepare the family's meals. The whole thing is pretty shabby, which wouldn't be so awful if it were owned by some underfunded local literary society and they were doing the best they could with it. In fact, it is owned by the city of Hannibal, and it draws 135,000 visitors a year. It's a little gold mine for the town. I proceeded from window to window behind a bald, fat guy, whose abundant rolls of flesh made him look as if he were wearing an assortment of inner tubes beneath his shirt. What do you think of it? I asked him. He fixed me with that instant friendliness Americans freely adopt with strangers.
It is their most becoming trait.
Oh, I think it's great. I come here whenever I'm in Hannibal, 2-3 times a year. Sometimes I go out of my way to come here.
Really? I tried not to sound dumbfounded.
Yeah, I must have been here 20-30 times by now. This is a real shrine, you know.
You think it's well done?
Oh, for sure.
Would you say the house is just like Twain described it in his books?
I don't know, the man said thoughtfully. I've never read one of his books.
Next door, attached to the house, was a small museum, which was better. There were cases of Twain memorabilia, first editions, one of his typewriters, photographs, some letters. There was precious little to link him to the house or the town. It is worth remembering that Twain got the hell out of both Hannibal and Missouri as soon as he could, and was always disinclined to come back. I went outside and looked around. Beside the house was a white fence with a sign saying, Tom Sawyer's Fence. Here stood the board fence which Tom Sawyer persuaded his gang to pay him for the pleasure of whitewashing. Tom sat by and saw that it was well done. Really wakes up your interest in literature, doesn't it? Next door to the Twain House and Museum, and I mean absolutely right next to it, was a Mark Twain drive-in restaurant and dinette, with cars parked in little bays and people grazing off trays attached to their windows. It really lent the scene a touch of class. I began to understand why Clemens didn't just leave town, but also changed his name. I strolled around the business district. The whole area was a dispiriting combination of auto parts stores, empty buildings, and vacant lots. I had always thought that all river towns, even the poor ones, had something about them, a kind of faded elegance, a raffish air, that made them more interesting than other towns, that the river served as a conduit to the larger world and washed up a more interesting and sophisticated brand of detritus. But not Hannibal. It had obviously had better days, but even they couldn't have been all that great. The Hotel Mark Twain was boarded up. That's a sad sight, a tall building with every window plugged with plywood. Every business in town appeared to trade on Twain and his books. The Mark Twain Roofing Company, the Mark Twain Savings and Loan, the Tom and Huck Motel, the Injun Joe Campground and Go-Kart Track, the Huck Finn Shopping Center. You could even go and be insane at the Mark Twain Mental Health Center, a possibility that would, I imagine, grow increasingly likely with every day spent in Hannibal. The whole place was sad and awful. I had been planning to stay for lunch, but the thought of having to face a Tom Sawyer burger or Injun Joe cola left me without any appetite for either food or Hannibal. I walked back to the car. Every parked car along the street had a license plate that said Missouri, the Show-Me State. I wondered idly if this could be short for Show Me the Way to Any Other State. In any case, I crossed the Mississippi, still muddy, still strangely unimpressive, on a long, high bridge, and turned my back on Missouri without regret. On the other side, a sign said, Buckle up. It's, without an apostrophe, the law in Illinois. Just beyond it, another said, And we still can't punctuate. I plunged east into Illinois. I was heading for Springfield, the state capital, and New Salem, a restored village where Abraham Lincoln lived as a young man. My dad had taken us there when I was about 5, and I thought it was wonderful. I wondered if it still was. I also wanted to see if Springfield was in any way an ideal town. One of the things I was looking for on this trip was the perfect town. I've always felt certain that somewhere out there in America it must exist. When I was small, WHO-TV in Des Moines used to show old movies every afternoon after school. And when other children were out playing kick the can or catching bullfrogs or encouraging little Bobby Birnbaum to eat worms, something he did with surprising amenability, I was alone in a curtained room in front of the TV, lost in a private world, with a plate of Oreo cookies on my lap and Hollywood magic flickering on my glasses. I didn't realize it at the time, but the films WHO showed were mostly classics. The Best Years of Our Lives, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, It Happened One Night. The one constant in these pictures was a background. It was always the same. a trim and sunny little city with a tree-lined main street full of friendly merchants.
Good morning, Mrs. Smith.
And a courthouse square, and wooded neighborhoods where fine houses slumbered beneath graceful elms. There was always a paper boy on a bike slinging papers onto front porches, and a genial old fart in a white apron sweeping the sidewalk in front of his drugstore, and two men striding briskly past. These two background men always wore suits, and they always strode smartly, never strolled or ambled, but strode in perfect harmony. They were really good at it. No matter what was going on in the foreground, Humphrey Bogart blowing away a bad guy with a .45, Jimmy Stewart earnestly explaining his ambitions to Donna Reed, W.C. Fields lighting a cigar with a cellophane still on it, the background was always this timeless, tranquil place. Even in the midst of the most dreadful crises, when monster ants were at large in the streets, or buildings were collapsing from some careless scientific experiment out at State University, you could still generally spot the paper boys slinging newspapers somewhere in the background, and those two guys in suits striding along like Siamese twins. They were absolutely imperturbable. And it wasn't just in the movies. Everybody on TV, Ozzie and Harriet, Wally and Beaver Cleaver, George Burns and Gracie Allen, lived in this middle-class Elysium. So did the people in the advertisements in magazines and on the commercials on television and in the Norman Rockwell paintings in the covers of the Saturday Evening Post. In books it was the same. I used to read Hardy Boys mysteries one after the other. Not for the plots, which even at the age of 8 I could see were ridiculously improbable.
Say, Frank, do you suppose those fellows with the funny accents that we saw at Moose Lake yesterday weren't really fishermen, but German spies? And that the girl in the bottom of their canoe with a bandage around her mouth wasn't really suffering from pyorrhea, but was actually Dr. Rorschach's daughter? I've got a funny feeling those fellows might even be able to tell us a thing or two about the missing rocket fuel.
No, I read them for Franklin W. Dixon's evocative, albeit incidental, descriptions of Bayport, the Hardy Boys' hometown, a place inexpressibly picturesque, where houses with porch swings and picket fences peeked out on a blue sweep of bay full of sailing boats and skimming launches. It was a place of constant adventures and summers without end. It began to bother me that I had never seen this town. Every year on vacation we would drive hundreds and hundreds of miles across the country in an insane pursuit of holiday happiness, toiling over blue hills and brown prairies, through towns and cities without number, but without ever going through anywhere even remotely like that dreamy town in the movies. The places we passed through were hot and dusty and full of scrawny dogs, closed-down movie theaters, grubby diners, and gas stations that looked as if they would be grateful to get 2 customers a week. But I felt sure that it must exist somewhere. It was inconceivable that a nation so firmly attached to small-town ideals, so dedicated in its fantasies to small-town notions, could not have somewhere built one perfect place. A place of harmony and industry, a place without shopping malls and oceanic parking lots, without factories and drive-in churches, without quick craps and jiffy shits and commercial squalor from one end to the other. In this timeless place, Bing Crosby would be the priest, Jimmy Stewart the mayor, Fred McMurray the high school principal, Henry Fonda a Quaker farmer, Walter Brennan would run the gas station, a boyish Mickey Rooney would deliver groceries. And somewhere at an open window, Deanna Durbin would sing. And in the background, always, would be the kid on a bike and those two smartly striding men. The place I was looking for would be an amalgam of all those towns I had encountered in fiction. Indeed, that might well be its name. Amalgam, Ohio, or Amalgam, North Dakota. It could exist almost anywhere. But it had to exist. And on this trip, I intended to find it. I drove through flat farming country and little towns devoid of life. Hull, Pittsfield, Barry, Oxville. On my map, Springfield was about 2 inches to the right of Hannibal, but it seemed to take hours to get there. In fact, it does take hours to get there. I was only slowly adjusting to the continental scale of America, where states are the size of countries. Illinois is nearly twice as big as Austria, 4 times the size of Switzerland. There is so much emptiness, so much space between towns. You go through a little place, and the dinette looks crowded, so you think, "Oh, I'll wait till I get to Fudville before I stop for coffee, because it's only just down the road." And then you get out on the highway, and a sign says, "Fudville, 102 miles. And you realize that you are dealing with another scale of geography altogether. There is a corresponding lack of detail on the maps. On British maps, every church and public house is dutifully recorded. Rivers of laughable minuteness, rivers you can step across, are landmarks of importance known for miles around. In America, whole towns go missing. Places with schools, businesses, hundreds of quiet little lives just vanish, as effectively as if they had been vaporized. And the system of roads is only cruelly hinted at. You look at the map and you think you spy a shortcut between, say, Wienerville and Bewilderment, a straight gray line of county road that promises to shave 30 minutes from your driving time. But when you leave the main highway, you find yourself in a network of unrecorded back roads radiating out across the countryside like cracks in a pane of broken glass. The whole business of finding your way around becomes laden with frustration, especially away from the main roads. Near Jacksonville, I missed a left turn for Springfield and had to go miles out of my way to get back to where I wanted to be. This happens a lot in America. The highway authorities are curiously reluctant to impart much in the way of useful information, like where you are or what road you are on. This is all the more strange when you consider that they are only too happy to provide all kinds of peripheral facts. Now entering Bubb County Soil Conservation District. National Sprat Hatchery, 5 miles. No parking, Wednesday 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. Danger, low-flying geese. Now leaving Bubb County Soil Conservation District. Often on country roads you will come to a crossroads without signposts, and then have to drive 20 miles or more without having any confidence in where you are. And then abruptly, without warning, you round a bend and find yourself at an 8-lane intersection with 14 traffic lights and the most bewildering assortment of signs, all with arrows pointing in different directions. Lake Maggot State Park, this way. Curtis Dribble Memorial Expressway, over there. U.S. Highway 41 South. U.S. Highway 53 North. Interstate 1178. Business District, this way. Dextrose County Teachers College, that way. Junction 17 West. Junction 17, not west. No U-turn. Left lane must turn left. Buckle your seatbelt. Sit up straight. Did you brush your teeth this morning? Just as you realize that you should be 3 lanes to the left, the lights change and you're swept off with the traffic like a cork on a fast river. This sort of thing used to happen to my father all the time. I don't think Dad ever went through a really big and important intersection without getting siphoned off to somewhere he didn't want to be. A black hole of one-way streets, an expressway into the desert, a long and expensive toll bridge to some offshore island, necessitating an embarrassing and costly return trip.
Hey, mister, didn't you come through here a minute ago from the other direction?
My father's particular speciality was the ability to get hopelessly lost without ever actually losing sight of the target. He never arrived at an amusement park or tourist attraction without first approaching it from several directions, like a pilot making passes over an unfamiliar airport. My sister and brother and I, bouncing on the back seat, could always see it on the other side of the freeway and cry, "There it is! There it is!" Then after a minute we would spy it from another angle on the far side of a cement works, and then across a broad river, and then on the other side of the freeway again. Sometimes all that would separate us from our goal would be a high chain-link fence. On the other side, you could see happy, carefree families parking their cars and getting ready for a wonderful day.
"How do they get in there?" my dad would cry, the veins on his forehead lively. "Why can't the city put up some signs, for Christ's sake? It's no wonder you can't find your way into the place," he would add, conveniently overlooking the fact that 18,000 other people, some of them of decidedly limited mental acuity, had managed to get on to the right side of the barbed wire without too much difficulty.
Springfield was a disappointment. I wasn't really surprised. If it were a nice place, someone would have said to me, "Say, you should go to Springfield. It's a nice place." I had high hopes for it only because I had always thought it sounded promising. In a part of the world where so many places have harsh, foreign-sounding names full of hard consonants, DeKalb, DeKoyne, Keokuk, Kankakee, Springfield is a little piece of poetry, a name suggesting grassy meadows and cool waters. In fact, it was nothing of the sort. Like all small American cities, it had a downtown of parking lots and tallish buildings, surrounded by a sprawl of shopping centers, gas stations, and fast food joints. It was neither offensive nor charming. I drove around a little bit, but finding nothing worth stopping for, I drove on to New Salem, 12 miles to the north. New Salem had a short and not very successful life. The original settlers intended to cash in on the river trade that passed by. But in fact, the river trade did just that, passed by, and the town never prospered. In 1837, it was abandoned and would no doubt have been lost to history altogether, except that one of its residents from 1831 to 1837 was a young Abraham Lincoln. So now, on a 620-acre site, New Salem has been rebuilt, just as it was when Lincoln lived there, and you can go and see why everybody was pretty pleased to clear off. Actually, it was very nice. There were about 30 or 40 log cabins, distributed around a series of leafy clearings. It was a gorgeous autumn afternoon, with a warm breeze and soft sunlight adrift in the trees. It all looked impossibly quaint and appealing. You're not allowed to go in the houses. Instead, you walk up to each one and peer through the windows or front door, and you get an idea of what life was like for the people who lived there. Mostly, it must have been pretty uncomfortable. Every house had a sign telling you about its residents. The historical research was impressively diligent. The only problem was that it all became a little repetitive after a while. Once you have looked through the windows of 14 log cabins, you find yourself approaching number 15 with a certain diminution of enthusiasm. And by the time you reach number 20, it is really only politeness that impels you onward. Since they've taken the trouble to build all these cabins and scour the country digging out old rocking chairs and chamber pots, you feel that the least you can do is walk around and feign interest at each one. But in your heart, you're really thinking that if you never saw a log cabin again, you'd be pretty damn pleased. I'm sure that was what Lincoln was thinking when he packed his cases and decided not to be a backwoods merchant anymore, but to take up a more rewarding career, emancipating Negroes and being president. Down at the far end of the site, I met an older couple, plodding towards me, looking tired. The man gave me a sympathetic look as he passed and said, "Only two more to go." Down the path from where they had come, I could see one of the two remaining cabins, looking distant and small. I waited until the older couple were safely out of sight around a bend, and then sat down beneath a tree, a handsome oak, into whose leaves the first trace of autumn gold was delicately bleeding. I felt a weight lifting from my shoulders and wondered why it was that I had been so enchanted by this place when I was 5 years old. Were childhood so boring back then? I knew my own little boy, if driven to this place, would drop to the ground and start hyperventilating at the discovery that he had spent a day and a half sealed in a car only to come and see a bunch of boring log cabins. And looking at it now, I couldn't have blamed him. I mused for a few moments on the question of which was worse, to lead a life so boring that you were easily enchanted, or a life so full of stimulus that you were easily bored. But then it occurred to me that musing is a pointless waste of anyone's time, and instead I went off to see if I could find a Baby Ruth candy bar, a far more profitable exercise. After New Salem, I took Interstate 55 south and drove for an hour and a half toward St. Louis. It was boring, too. On a road as straight and as wide as an American interstate, 55 miles an hour is just too slow. It feels like walking speed. Cars and trucks coming towards you on the opposite carriageway seem to be traveling on one of those pedestrian conveyor belts you find in airports. You can see the people inside, get a long, lingering glimpse into their lives as they slide past. And there's no sense of driving. You need to put a hand to the wheel occasionally just to confirm your course, but you can take time out to do the most intricate things. Count your money, brush your hair, tidy up the car, use the rearview mirror to search and destroy blackheads, read maps and guidebooks, put on or discard articles of clothing. If your car possessed cruise control, you could just about climb in the back and take a nap. It is certainly quite easy to forget that you are in charge of 2 tons of speeding metal, and it is only when you start to scatter emergency cones at roadwork sites, or a truck honks at you as you drift into its path, that you are jolted back to reality And you realize that henceforth you probably shouldn't leave your seat to search for snack food. The one thing that can be said is that it leaves you time to think, and to consider questions like, why is it that the trees along highways never grow? Some of them must have been there for 40 years by now, and yet they are still no more than 6 feet tall, and with only 14 leaves on them. Is it a particular low-maintenance strain, do you suppose? And here's another one. Why can't they make cereal boxes with pouring spouts? Is some guy at General Foods splitting his sides at the thought that every time people pour out a bowl of cornflakes, they spill some of it on the floor? And why is it that when you clean a sink, no matter how long you let the water run or how much you wipe it with a cloth, there's always a strand of hair and some bits of wet fluff left behind? And just what do the Spanish see in flamenco music? In a forlorn effort to keep from losing my mind, I switched on the radio, but then I remembered that American radio was designed for people who have already lost their minds. The first thing I came across was a commercial for Folgers Coffee. An announcer said in a confidential whisper, "We went to the world-famous Napa Valley restaurant in California and, without telling the customers, served them Folgers instant coffee instead of the restaurant's usual brand. Then we listened in on hidden microphones." There followed an assortment of praise for the coffee along the lines of, "Hey, this coffee is fantastic!
I've never tasted such rich, full-bodied coffee before.
This coffee is so good, I can hardly stand it!"
And that sort of thing. Then the announcer leapt out and told the diners that it was Folgers coffee, and they all shared a good laugh. And an important lesson about the benefits of drinking quality instant coffee. I twirled the dial. A voice said, "We'll return to our discussion of maleness in 60 seconds. I twirled the dial. The warbling voice of a female country singer intoned,
"His hands are tiny, his arms are short, but I lean on him for my child support."
I twirled the dial. A voice said,
"This portion of the news is brought to you by the Airport Barbershop, Biloxi."
There was then a commercial for the said barbershop, followed by 30 seconds of news, all of it related to deaths by cars, fires, and gunfire in Biloxi in the last 24 hours. There was no hint that there might be a wider, yet more violent world beyond the city limits. Then there was another commercial for the airport barbershop, in case you were so monumentally cretinous that you'd forgotten about it during the preceding 30 seconds of news. I switched the radio off. At Litchfield, I left the interstate, vowing not to get on one again if I could possibly help it, and joined a state highway, Illinois 127, heading south toward Murfreesboro and Carbondale. Almost immediately, life became more interesting. There were farms and houses and little towns to look at. I was still going 55 miles an hour, but now I seemed to be fairly skimming along. The landscape flashed past, more absorbing than before, more hilly and varied, and the foliage was a darker blur of green. Signs came and went. TP Mini Mart, Be Right Food Store, Betty's Beauty Box, Save-A-Lot Food Center, Pinckneyville Coon Club, Bald Knob Trailer Court, Dairy Delight, All You Can Eat. In between these shrines of dyslexia and free enterprise, there were clearings on the hillsides where farmhouses stood. Almost every one had a satellite dish in the yard, pointed to the sky as if tapping into some life-giving celestial force. I suppose, in a sense, they were. Here in the hills, the light failed more quickly. I noticed with surprise that it was past 6 o'clock, and I decided that I had better find a room. As if on cue, Carbondale hove into view. It used to be that when you came to the outskirts of a town, you would find a gas station and a Dairy Queen, maybe a motel or two if it was a busy road or the town had a college. Now, every town, even a quite modest one, has a mile or more of fast food places, motor inns, discount cities, shopping malls, all with 30-foot-high revolving signs and parking lots the size of Shropshire. Carbondale appeared to have nothing else. I drove in on a road that became a 2-mile strip of shopping centers and gas stations, Kmarts, JCPenney's, Hardee's, and McDonald's. And then abruptly, I was in the country again. I turned around and drove back through town on a parallel street that offered precisely the same sorts of things, but in slightly different configurations, and then I was in the country again. The town had no center. It had been eaten by shopping malls. I got a room in the Heritage Motor Inn, then went out for a walk to try once more to find Carbondale. But there was nothing there. I was perplexed and disillusioned. Before I'd left on the Strip, I had lain awake at night in my bed in England and pictured myself stopping each evening at a motel in a little city, strolling into town along sidewalks, dining on the Blue Plate special at Betty's Family Restaurant in the town square, then plugging a scented toothpick in my mouth and going for a stroll around the town, very probably stopping off at Vern's Midnight Tavern for a couple of draws and a game of eight-ball with the boys, or taking in a movie at the Regal, or looking in at the Valhalla Bowling Alley to kibitz the midweek Hairdressers League matches, before rounding off the night with a couple of games of pinball and a grilled cheese sandwich. But here, there was no square to stroll to, no Betty's, no Blue Plate specials, no Vern's Midnight Tavern, no movie theater, no bowling alley. There was no town, just six-lane highways and shopping malls. There weren't even any sidewalks. Going for a walk, as I discovered, was a ridiculous and impossible undertaking. I had to cross parking lots and gas station forecourts, and I kept coming up against little white-painted walls marking the boundaries between, say, Long John Silver's Seafood Shoppie and Kentucky Fried Chicken. To get from one to the other, it was necessary to clamber over the wall, scramble up a grassy embankment, and pick your way through a thicket of parked cars. That is, if you were on foot. But clearly, from the looks people gave me as I lumbered breathlessly over the embankment, no one had ever tried to go from one of these places to another under his own motive power. What you were supposed to do was get in your car, drive 12 feet down the street to another parking lot, park the car, and get out. Glumly, I clambered my way to a Pizza Hut and went inside, where a waitress seated me at a table with a view of the parking lot. All around me, people were eating pizzas the size of bus wheels. Directly opposite, inescapably in my line of vision, an overweight man of about 30 was lowering wedges into his mouth whole, like a sword swallower. The menu was dazzling in its variety. It went on for pages. There were so many types and sizes of pizza, so many possible permutations, that I felt quite at a loss. The waitress appeared.
"Are you ready to order?"
"I'm sorry," I replied. "I need a little more time."
"Sure," she said. "You take your time."
She went off to somewhere out of my line of vision, counted to four, and came back.
"Are you ready to order now?"
she asked. "I'm sorry," I said. "I really need just a little more time."
"Okay,"
she said and left. This time she may have counted as high as 20, but when she returned I was still nowhere near understanding the many hundreds of options open to me as a Pizza Hut patron.
"You're kind of slow, aren't you?"
she observed brightly. I was embarrassed. "I'm sorry, I'm out of touch. I've just got out of prison." Her eyes widened.
"Really?"
"Yes. I murdered a waitress who rushed me." With an uncertain smile, she backed off and gave me lots and lots of time to make up my mind. In the end, I had a medium-sized deep-dish pepperoni pizza with extra onions and mushrooms, and I can recommend it without hesitation. Afterwards, to round off a perfect evening, I clambered over to a nearby Kmart and had a look around. Kmarts are a chain of discount stores, and they are really depressing places. You could take Mother Teresa to a Kmart and she would get depressed. It's not that there's anything wrong with the Kmarts themselves, it's the customers. Kmarts are always full of the sort of people who give their children names that rhyme. Lonnie, Donnie, Ronnie, Connie, Bonnie. The sort of people who would stay in to watch the Munsters. Every woman there has at least 4 children, and they all look as if they have been fathered by a different man. The woman always weighs 250 pounds. She's always walloping a child and bawling,
"If you don't behave, Ronnie, I'm not going to bring you back here no more."
As if Ronnie could give a toss about never going to a Kmart again. It's the place you would go if you wanted to buy a stereo system for under $35 and didn't care if it sounded like the band was playing in a mailbox underwater in a distant lake. If you go shopping at Kmart, you know that you've touched bottom. My dad liked Kmarts. I went in and looked around. I picked up some disposable razors and a pocket notebook, and then, just to make an occasion of it, a bag of Reese's peanut butter cups, which are attractively priced at $1.29. I paid for these and went outside. It was 7:30 in the evening. The stars were rising above the parking lot. I was alone with a small bag of pathetic treats in the most boring town in America. And frankly, I felt sorry for myself. I clambered over a wall and dodged across the highway to a quick crap mini supermarket, purchased a cold six-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and returned with it to my room where I watched cable TV, drank beer, messily ate Reese's peanut butter cups, wiping my hands on the sheets, and drew meager comfort from the thought that in Carbondale, Illinois, that was about as good a time as you were ever likely to get. Chapter 5. In the morning, I rejoined Highway 127 South. This was marked on my map as a scenic route, and for once this proved to be so. It really was attractive countryside, better than anything I knew Illinois possessed, with rolling hills of wine bottle green, prosperous-looking farms, and deep woods of oak and beech. Surprisingly, considering I was heading south, the foliage here was more autumnal than elsewhere. The hillsides were a mixture of mustard, dull orange, and pale green, quite fetching, and the clear, sunny air had an agreeable crispness to it. I could live here in these hills, I thought. It took me a while to figure out what was missing. It was billboards. When I was small, billboards 30 feet wide and 15 feet high stood in fields along every roadside. In places like Iowa and Kansas, they were about the only stimulation you got. In the 1960s, Lady Bird Johnson, in one of those misguided campaigns in which presidents' wives are always engaging themselves, had most of the roadside billboards removed as part of a highway beautification program. In the middle of the Rocky Mountains, this was doubtless a good thing, but out here, in the lonesome heartland, billboards were practically a public service. Seeing one standing a mile off, you would become interested to see what it said, and would watch with mild absorption as it advanced towards you and passed. As roadside excitements went, it was on about a par with a little windmills and Pella, but it was better than nothing. The superior billboards would have a three-dimensional element to them, the head of a cow jutting out if it was for a dairy, or a cutout of a bowling ball scattering pins if it was for a bowling alley. Sometimes the billboard would be for some coming attraction. There might be a figure of a ghost, and the words, "Visit Spook Caverns, Oklahoma's great family attraction, just 69 miles. A couple of miles later, there would be another sign saying, "Plenty of free parking at Spook Caverns, just 67 miles. And so it would go, with sign after sign promising the most thrilling and instructive afternoon any family could ever hope to have, at least in Oklahoma. These promises would be supported by illustrations showing eerily lit underground chambers, the size of cathedrals, in which the stalactites and stalagmites had magically fused into the shapes of witches' houses, bubbling cauldrons, flying bats, and Casper the Friendly Ghost. It all looked extremely promising, so we children in the back would begin suggesting that we stop and have a look, taking it in turns to say in a sincere and moving way, "Oh, please, Dad. Oh, please." Over the next 60 miles, my father's position on the matter would proceed through a series of well-worn phases, beginning with a flat refusal on the grounds that it was bound to be expensive, and anyway our behavior since breakfast had been so disgraceful that it didn't warrant any special treats, to studiously ignoring our pleas. This phase would last for up to 11 minutes, to asking my mother privately in a low voice what she thought about the idea and receiving an unequivocal answer, to ignoring us again in the evident hope that we would forget about it and stop nagging, 1 minute 12 seconds, to saying that we might go if we started to behave and kept on behaving more or less forever, to saying that we definitely would not go because, just look at us, we were already squabbling again and we hadn't even gotten there, to finally announcing, sometimes in an exasperated bellow, sometimes in a deathbed whisper, that all right, we would go. You could always tell when Dad was on the brink of acceptance because his neck would turn red. It was always the same. He always said yes in the end. I never understood why he didn't just accede to our demands at the outset and save himself 30 minutes of anguish. Then he would always quickly add, "But we're only going for half an hour, and you're not going to buy anything, is that clear?" This seemed to restore to him a sense that he was in charge of things. By the last 2 or 3 miles, the signs for Spook Caverns would be every couple of 100 yards, bringing us to a fever pitch of excitement.
Finally, there would be a billboard the size of a battleship with a huge arrow telling us to turn right here and drive 18 miles.
18 miles!
Dad would cry shrilly, his forehead veins stirring to life in preparation for the inevitable discovery that after 18 miles of bouncing down a dirt road with knee-deep ruts, there would be no sign of Spook Caverns. That indeed, after 19 miles, the road would end in a desolate junction without any clue to which way to turn, and that Dad would turn the wrong way. When eventually found, Spook Caverns would prove to be rather less than advertised. In fact, would give every appearance of being in the last stages of solvency. The caverns, damp and ill-lit and smelling like a long dead horse, would be about the size of a garage, and the stalactites and stalagmites wouldn't look the least bit like witches' houses and Casper the Ghost. They would look like, well, like stalactites and stalagmites. It would all be a huge letdown. The only possible way of assuaging our disappointment, we would discover, would be if Dad brought us each a rubber Bowie knife and a bag of plastic dinosaurs in the adjoining gift shop. My sister and I would drop to the ground and emit mournful noises to remind him what a fearful thing unassuaged grief can be in a child. So, as the sun sank over the brown flatness of Oklahoma, and Dad, hours behind schedule, embarked on the difficult business of not being able to find a room for the night, ably assisted by my mother, who would misread the maps and mistakenly identify almost every approaching building as a possible motel, we children would pass the time in the back by having noisy and vicious knife fights, breaking off at intervals to weep, report wounds, and complain of hunger, boredom, and the need for toilet facilities. It was a kind of living hell. And now there appeared to be almost no billboards along the highways. What a sad loss. I headed for Cairo, which is spelt the same way as Cairo, but is pronounced Cairo. I don't know why. They do this a lot in the South and Midwest. In Kentucky, Athens is pronounced Athens, and Versailles is pronounced Versailles. Bolivar, Missouri is Bolivar. Madrid, Iowa is Madrid. I don't know whether the people in these towns pronounce them that way because they are backward, undereducated shit-kickers who don't know any better, or whether they know better but don't care that everybody thinks they are backward, undereducated shit-kickers. It's not really the sort of question you can ask them, is it? At Cairo, I stopped for gas, and in fact I did ask the old guy who dotted out to fill my tank why they pronounced Cairo as they did. "Because that's its name," he explained, as if I were kind of stupid. "But the one in Egypt is pronounced Cairo."
"So I've heard," agreed the man.
"And most people, when they see the name, think Cairo, don't they?"
"Not in Cairo, they don't," he said a little hotly. There didn't seem to be much to be gained by pursuing the point, so I let it rest there.
And I still don't know why the people call it Cairo. Nor do I know why any citizen of a free country would choose to live in such a dump, however you pronounce it. Cairo is at the point where the Ohio River, itself a great artery, joins the Mississippi, doubling its grandeur. You would think that at the confluence of two such mighty rivers, there would be a great city. But in fact, Cairo is a poor little town of 6,000 people. The road in was lined with battered houses and unpainted tenements. Aged black men sat on the porches and stoops, on old sofas and rocking chairs, waiting for death or dinner, whichever came first. This surprised me. You didn't expect to see tenements and porches full of black people in the Midwest, at least not outside big cities like Chicago and Detroit. But then I realized that I was no longer really in the Midwest. The speech patterns of southern Illinois are more southern than Midwestern. I was nearly as far south as Nashville. Mississippi was only 160 miles away, and Kentucky was just across the river. I crossed it now on a long, high bridge. From here on down to Louisiana, the Mississippi is immensely broad. It looks safe and lazy, but in fact it is full of danger. Scores of people die in it every year. Farmers out fishing stare at the water and think, "I wonder what would happen if I just stuck my toe in there a little bit." And the next thing you know, their bodies bob up in the Gulf of Mexico, bloated but looking strangely serene. The river is deceptively fierce. In 1927, when the Mississippi overflowed, it flooded an area the size of Scotland. That is a serious river. On the Kentucky side of the river, I was greeted by huge signs everywhere saying, "Fireworks!" In Illinois,
Fireworks are illegal. In Kentucky, they are not. So if you live in Illinois and you want to blow your hand off, you drive across the river to Kentucky. You used to see a lot more of this sort of thing. If one state had a lower sales tax on cigarettes than a neighboring state, all the state-line gas stations and cafes would put big signs on their roof saying, "Tax-free cigarettes! 40 cents a pack! No tax!" And all the people from the next state would come and load their cars up with cut-price cigarettes. Wisconsin used to ban margarine to protect its dairy farmers, so everybody in Wisconsin, including all the dairy farmers, would drive to Iowa, where there were big signs everywhere saying, "Margarine for sale!" All the Iowans in the meantime were driving off to Illinois, where there was no sales tax on anything, or Missouri, where the sales tax on gasoline was 50% lower. The other thing you used to get a lot of was states going their own way in terms of daylight saving time. So in the summer, Illinois might be 2 hours adrift from Iowa and 1 hour behind Indiana. It was all kind of crazy, but it made you realize to what an extent the United States is really 50 independent countries, 48 countries in those days. Most of that seems to have gone now. Yet another sad loss. I drove through Kentucky thinking of sad losses, and was abruptly struck by the saddest loss of all, the Burma Shave sign. Burma Shave was a shaving cream that came in a tube. I don't know if it's still produced. In fact, I never knew anyone who ever used it. But the Burma Shave Company used to put clever signs along the highway. They came in clusters of five, expertly spaced, so that you read them as a little poem as you passed. If harmony is what you crave, then get a tuba Burma Shave. Or, Ben met Anna, made a hit. Neglected beard, Ben Anna split. Great, eh? Even in the 1950s, the Burma Shave signs were pretty much a thing of the past. I can only remember seeing half a dozen in all the thousands of miles of highway we covered. But as roadside diversions went, they were outstanding. 10 times better than billboards and Pella's little twirling windmills. The only thing that surpassed them for diversion value were multiple car pileups with bodies strewn about the highway. Kentucky was much like southern Illinois, hilly, sunny, attractive, but the scattered houses were less tidy and prosperous-looking than in the north. There were lots of wooded valleys and iron bridges over twisting creeks, and an abundance of dead animals pasted to the road. In every valley stood a little white Baptist church, and all along the road were signs to remind me that I was now in the Bible Belt. Jesus saves, praise the Lord, Christ is King. I was out of Kentucky almost before I knew it. The state tapers to a point at its western edge, and I was cutting across a chunk of it only 40 miles wide. In a veritable eye-blink, in terms of American traveling time, I was in Tennessee. It isn't often you can dispense with a state in less than an hour, and Tennessee would not detain me much longer. It's an odd-looking state, shaped like a Dutch brick, stretching more than 500 miles from east to west, but only 100 miles from top to bottom. Its landscape was much the same as that of Kentucky and Illinois, indeterminate farming country laced with rivers, hills, and religious zealots. But I was surprised when I stopped for lunch at a Burger King in Jackson at how warm it was. It was 83 degrees, according to a sign on the drive-in bank across the street, a good 20 degrees higher than it had been in Carbondale that morning. I was still obviously deep in the Bible Belt. A sign in the yard of a church next door said, "Christ is the answer." The question, of course, is, what do you say when you strike your thumb with a hammer? I went into the Burger King. A girl at the counter said, "Can I help you?" I had entered another country. Chapter 6. Just south of Grand Junction, Tennessee, I passed over the state line into Mississippi. A sign beside the highway said, "Welcome to Mississippi. We shoot to kill." It didn't really. I just made that up. This was only the second time I'd ever been to the Deep South, and I entered it with a sense of foreboding. It is surely no coincidence that all those films you have ever seen about the South, Easy Rider, In the Heat of the Night, Cool Hand Luke, Brubaker, Deliverance, depict Southerners as murderous, incestuous, shitty-shoed rednecks. It really is another country. Years ago, in the days of Vietnam, 2 friends and I drove to Florida during college spring break. We all had long hair. En route, we took a shortcut across the back roads of Georgia, and stopped late one afternoon for a burger at a dinette in some dreary little crudville. And when we took our seats at the counter, the place fell silent. 14 people just stopped eating, their food resting in their mouths, and stared at us. It was so quiet in there you could have heard a fly fart. A whole roomful of good old boys with cherry-colored cheeks and bib overalls watched us in silence and wondered whether their shotguns were loaded. It was disconcerting. To them, out here in the middle of nowhere, we were at once a curiosity. Some of them had clearly never seen no long-haired, nigger-loving, northern college-educated commie hippies in the flesh before, and yet unspeakably loathsome. It was an odd sensation to feel so deeply hated by people who hadn't really had a proper chance to acquaint themselves with one's shortcomings. I remember thinking that our parents didn't have the first idea where we were, other than that we were somewhere in the continental vastness between Des Moines and the Florida Keys, and that if we disappeared, we would never be found. I had visions of my family sitting around the living room in years to come, and my mother saying, "Well, I wonder whatever happened to Billy and his friends. You'd think we'd have had a postcard by now. Can I get anybody a sandwich?" That sort of thing did really happen down there, you know. This was only 5 years after 3 Freedom Riders were murdered in Mississippi. They were a 21-year-old black from Mississippi named James Cheney and 2 white guys from New York, Andrew Goodman, 20, and Michael Schwerner, 20. I give their names because they deserve to be remembered. They were arrested for speeding, taken to the Neshoba County Jail in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and never seen again. At least, not until weeks later when their bodies were hauled out of a swamp. These were kids, remember? The police had released them to a waiting mob which had taken them away and done things to them that a child wouldn't do to an insect. The sheriff in the case, a smirking, tobacco-chewing fat boy named Lawrence Rainey, was acquitted of negligent behavior. No one was ever charged with murder. To me, this was, and always would be, the South. I followed Highway 7 south towards Oxford. It took me along the western edge of the Holly Springs National Forest, which seemed to be mostly swamp and scrubland. I was disappointed. I had half expected that as soon as I crossed into Mississippi, there would be Spanish mosses hanging from the trees, and women in billowy dresses twirling parasols, and white-haired colonels with handlebar mustaches drinking mint juleps on the lawn, while darkies gathered the cotton and sang sweet hymns. But this landscape was just scrubby and hot and nondescript. Occasionally there would be a shack set up on bricks with an old black man in a rocking chair on the porch, but precious little sign of life or movement elsewhere. At the town of Holly Springs stood a sign for Senatobia, and I got briefly excited. Senatobia! What a great name for a Mississippi town! All the stupidity and pomposity of the Old South seemed to be encapsulated in those 5 golden syllables. Maybe things were picking up. Maybe now I would see chain gangs toiling in the sun, and a prisoner in heavy irons legging it across fields and sloshing through creeks while pursued by bloodhounds, and lynch mobs roaming the streets and crosses burning on lawns. The prospect enlivened me, but I had to calm down because a state trooper pulled up alongside me at a traffic light and began looking me over with that sort of casual disdain you often get when you give a dangerously stupid person a gun in a squad car. He was sweaty and overweight and sat low in his seat. I assume he was descended from the apes like all the rest of us, but clearly in his case it had been a fairly gentle slope. I stared straight ahead with a look that I hoped conveyed seriousness of purpose, mingled with a warm heart and innocent demeanor. I could feel him looking at me. At the very least, I expected him to gob a wad of tobacco juice down the side of my head. Instead, he said, "How you doing?" This so surprised me that I answered in a cracking voice, "Pardon?" I said, "How you doing?" "I'm fine," I said, and then added, having lived some years in Britain, "Thank you."
"You on vacation?"
"Yep."
"How do you like Miss Hippie?"
"Pardon?"
"I say, how do you like Miss Hippie?"
I was quietly distressed. The man was armed and Southern, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying to me. "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm kind of slow, and I don't understand what you're saying."
"I say,"
and he repeated it more carefully,
How do ye like Mississippi?
It dawned on me. Oh, I like it fine. I like it heaps. I think it's wonderful. The people are so friendly and helpful. I wanted to add that I'd been there for an hour and hadn't been shot at once, but the light changed and he was gone, and I sighed and thought, thank you, Jesus.
I drove on to Oxford, home of the University of Mississippi, or Old Miss, as it's known. The people named the town after Oxford in England, in the hope that this would persuade the state to build the university there, and the state did. This tells you most of what you need to know about the workings of the Southern mind. Oxford appeared to be an agreeable town. It was built around a square, in the middle of which stood the Lafayette County Courthouse, with a tall clock tower and Doric columns, basking grandly in the Indian summer sunshine. Around the perimeter of the square were attractive stores and a tourist information office. I went into the tourist information office to get directions to Rowan Oak, William Faulkner's home. Faulkner lived in Oxford for the whole of his life, and his home is now a museum, preserved as it was on the day he died in 1962. It must be unnerving to be so famous that you know they're going to come in at the moment you croak and hang velvet cords across all the doorways and treat everything with reverence. Think of the embarrassment if you left a copy of Reader's Digest condensed books on the bedside table. Behind the desk,